Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the 20s, cloudy tomorrow with highs near 40, chance of rain in the afternoon, breezy south winds.
A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happened, but he knew nothing about it.
Meeting with Saudi Arabia's crown prince, President Trump downplayed the killing and dismembering of a Washington Post journalist.
It's Tuesday, November 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead, what it's like to be detained or arrested by ICE.
I still feel that fear, you know, that might happen again. Just for looking Mexican or, you know, Latino, they can again come up to me and just start questioning me.
And the second part of Wicked hits theaters this week.
We'll talk to actual witches about the popular franchise, whether they think it's good or whether there are things they'd change.
I am obsessed with Wicked. I love it. I cannot wait till the second half comes out.
Those stories and more coming up after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Congress has passed a bill compelling the Justice Department to release documents related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. President Trump threw his support behind the effort after initially opposing it. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports.
For weeks, President Trump and Republican House leadership fought a vote on the files. But once a bipartisan petition got enough signatures to force the issue, Trump reversed. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was among the Republicans pushing the disclosure, saying the victim, some of whom were watching in the chamber, deserved transparency.
This was a fight that we should have never had to wage. It should have been the easiest thing for every single member of Congress. It should have been the easiest thing for the Speaker of the House. It should have been the easiest thing for the President of the United States.
Trump says he will sign it. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
The bill's now headed to the president's desk after the Senate approved it by unanimous consent. The Trump administration unveiled its most extensive plans yet to dismantle the Department of Education, NPR's Corey Turner reports.
The department says it has signed six agreements with other federal agencies to essentially outsource the work of the Education Department. For example, work normally done by the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education will be moving to the Department of Labor, as will the work of the Office of Post-Secondary Education. Other work will shift to the State Department, Interior, and HHS. Staff will also be moving, with just a few Education Department leaders remaining behind to provide oversight. The Trump administration says this is all part of its plan to return education to the states. Critics say these offices were placed at the Education Department by Congress, and only Congress can move them. Corey Turner, NPR News.
NPR has been speaking with U.S. citizens swept up in President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration. NPR's Adrian Florido reports their stories are getting attention in Washington.
Javier Ramirez says when Border Patrol agents raided the auto junkyard where he works near Los Angeles, he heard one say to another,
I just hear him like, hey, just get him. He's Mexican. And that's when they threw me down to the ground.
Andrea Velez says the ICE agents who arrested her on an L.A. street kept addressing her in Spanish even after she declared her citizenship in English.
Like, they had not heard me before speak English. And then I was like, I speak English too.
Both say they were racially profiled. They may testify when congressional Democrats kick off a series of hearings later this month probing the treatment of U.S. citizens caught up in the government's immigration dragnet. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
A federal court has blocked Texas from using a congressional map that would give Republicans an edge in winning five more seats in Congress. President Trump urged lawmakers to pass the map. The ruling is a blow to GOP efforts to keep its narrow control of Congress. This is NPR News from Washington. The leader of an Eastern European neo-Nazi group has pleaded guilty in New York to recruiting others for violent attacks against Jews and racial minorities. The plans included a plot to dress as Santa Claus and hand out poisoned candy to children. Federal prosecutors say they will seek up to 18 years in prison for the Georgian national, Mikhail Chikvishvili. The U.S. and many other wealthy countries are cutting their foreign aid budgets. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports on an analysis suggesting those cuts could lead to millions of additional deaths.
Over the last couple of decades, wealthy countries have sent an increasing amount of money to poorer countries. That trend peaked in 2023 with a total of $250 billion in total foreign aid spending. That money helped drive down deaths by 23% in recipient countries, according to a new analysis by the Barcelona Institute for Global Health. High levels of aid were linked to a 70% drop in HIV deaths and cut malaria deaths in half. But that progress is threatened, the researchers say. Countries are on track to shrink total aid spending by more than 10% next year. If that continues, the study projects an additional 9.4 million people could die by 2030. That toll could more than double, the researchers say, if countries follow the U.S. and largely dismantle many aid programs. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
A wild dolphin named Mimo has been delighting Venetians for months with acrobatic flips. Experts want to move him after wounds indicated he'd likely been hit by a boat propeller. Agencies used acoustic devices to nudge Mimo out to sea, and it worked briefly, but he came back within an hour. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Programming is supported in part by MinSure, offering Minnesotans the opportunity to find discounts, compare private health plans, and see if they qualify for no-cost or low-cost insurance. Expert advice is also available. The enrollment deadline is December 18th for coverage starting January 1st. Information and enrollment online at minsure.org. More news is next on KAXE.
All Things Considered, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is at the White House today, and he received a warm welcome from President Trump. The men touted a deal between the two countries. NPR White House correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben is at the White House with more. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Danielle, I know that there is a whole lot of ceremony around the Crown Prince's arrival, and this evening there is a black tie dinner. What does all of this tell us about the way that President Trump is approaching this visit?
Well, it shows very clearly that Trump is really excited about the visit. After all, he's welcomed many foreign leaders this year, and he doesn't give them all swanky dinners. So the tone is celebratory. Already today in the Oval Office with the Crown Prince, Trump was emphasizing potential Saudi investments in the U.S. and really seemed excited about that. So we should expect a lot of investment talk. In fact, there's an event tomorrow called the U.S.-Saudi Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center, and it's set to include speakers from tech, oil, and medicine pharma companies. And so it's really meant to telegraph that the Saudi-U.S. partnership is going to be great for business.
Saudi Arabia has repeatedly come under fire for human rights abuses. I'm thinking specifically of the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, and that did come up during today's presser. Let's listen.
As far as this gentleman is concerned, he's done a phenomenal job. You're mentioning somebody that was extremely controversial. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But he knew nothing about it. And we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that.
And I'll note that U.S. intelligence has found that Mohammed bin Salman did approve the operation to kill Khashoggi. However, we should say that the Crown Prince does deny having a role. Tell us more about that exchange today.
Well, even before Khashoggi came up at the start of the meeting, Trump praised the Crown Prince on his human rights record. And then when a reporter asked about Khashoggi, as you heard, President Trump got angry and, shockingly, didn't condemn the killing and dismemberment of a journalist from an American news outlet. Rather, Trump called Khashoggi, who is Saudi, controversial. Now, the Crown Prince did answer after that, and he said the killing was a painful incident and that his country has taken steps to make sure nothing like that will ever happen again.
Right. Okay, we know that economics and security, they're both top priorities here. What deals are the U.S. and Saudi Arabia hoping to get out of this visit?
Well, let's start with what Saudi Arabia wants. That country wants to buy advanced F-35 jets, which Trump has said this week the U.S. will sell to them. Saudi Arabia also wants access to advanced AI chips, and they want U.S. assistance on developing nuclear power. Although today in that meeting, Trump said nuclear cooperation isn't urgent right now. But finally, the Saudis are looking for a defense pact. They want an agreement that the U.S. would help defend their country if they were attacked.
And what about what the U.S. wants?
Well, the Crown Prince has already said earlier this year that his country would do $600 billion in investments in the U.S. Today he said there could be even more investments than that, which Trump got pretty excited about. But also, Trump is going to be pushing Saudi Arabia to sign on to the Abraham Accords, which is a series of diplomatic deals he brokered in his first term between Israel and other Arab countries. But there's a pretty significant hurdle to that happening. Today, Mohammed bin Salman said he wants to be part of the Abraham Accords, but also wants a two-state solution. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, has said there will never be a Palestinian state.
Last thing, and quickly, Danielle, President Trump was also asked today about his family's business dealings in Saudi Arabia. How do you respond?
Well, he brushed off any concerns about conflicts of interest. He said he isn't involved in the family business right now. But the ties between the Trump Organization and Saudi Arabia are still there. For example, Trump-branded properties are being developed in Saudi Arabia.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you.
Thank you.
As President Trump expands his aggressive immigration crackdown to more cities across the country, dozens, if not hundreds, of U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents have been detained or arrested and sometimes held for days. NPR's Adrian Florido recently spoke with two of them about their experience.
It's been 5 months since Javier Ramirez, a U.S. citizen, was tackled and arrested by immigration agents. But he still wakes up in the middle of the night, gasping for breath, pumping his fists into the air as if he's fighting off an attacker.
Panic attacks. I still feel that fear. You know, that might happen again. Just for looking Mexican or, you know, Latino, they can again come up to me and just start questioning me.
On June 12th, masked Border Patrol agents out patrolling for immigrants to arrest walked into the auto junkyard east of Los Angeles where Ramirez was working. He saw them from the other side of the junkyard and walked through rows of broken cars to get to them.
I actually didn't see the guns or anything like that until literally I was literally close to them. That's when I'm like, oh, okay, wow. People with guns, that means no, you know, don't get close, you know, raise your hands.
A security camera captured what Ramirez says is an agent telling him in vulgar Spanish, don't be an idiot. Do you all have papers? Then he alleges he heard one of the agents say to another one,
I just hear him like, hey, just get him. He's Mexican. And that's when they throw me down to the ground.
Ramirez struggled and pleaded to be let go. The agents moved him and other workers out to the sidewalk as a crowd gathered. His brother heard the commotion from his own tow truck yard down the street and came over and started to film.
Yeah, he's just a U.S. citizen, bro. You're a citizen.
The agents loaded Ramirez into a van. He recalls how he managed to use his cell phone to call local police despite being handcuffed.
I'm calling 911. Hey, what's your emergency? Like, hey, I'm being kidnapped. I'm in a black van.
He says the dispatcher told him police had already been called about this, but couldn't help because these were federal agents.
I'm like, if they are, I'm a U.S. citizen. Why would they take a U.S. citizen?
Ramirez was held in a downtown L.A. prison for more than 4 days. He was charged with assaulting, resisting, or impeding a federal officer, but the charge was later dropped. Ramirez believes agents fabricated it to cover up for racially profiling him.
They pretty much seem like, you know what? He's a U.S. citizen. We messed up. So in order for them to not look bad, they amended these accusations.
Ramirez's lawyer is Michael Carrillo. He's also representing 10 other U.S. citizens or green card holders who've been arrested or detained by immigration agents. They're each seeking $1 million in damages from the federal government.
What's happening is that the Latino community, especially those with darker skin like myself, maybe that speak Spanish, listen to Spanish music, we are being racially profiled. What we've seen in these cases is that they stop, they detain people, sometimes arrest them, detain them for days, and then ask questions later. That's not right.
In a statement, the Department of Homeland Security said allegations that its agents racially profile are, quote, disgusting, reckless, and categorically false. The department does not release data on how many U.S. citizens it has detained or arrested. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem recently denied that any have been rounded up.
There's no American citizens have been arrested or detained. We focus on those that are here illegally. And anything that you would hear or report that would be different than that is simply not true and false reporting.
Totally false. It's just wrong. If she were to call my office and talk to these 10, 11 citizens that we represent, they would say, hey, I've been detained, I've been arrested, I've been thrown in custody for 5 days. So to me, it was an outrage to hear that.
Last month, reporting by ProPublica found at least 170 U.S. citizens who'd been detained or arrested, though it was likely an undercount. Since then, there's been reports of others. Many have been let go within minutes or hours. Others have been arrested and held for days. Lawsuits alleging racial profiling and rights violations are piling up. Carrillo says he's outraged by the racism he says he sees. ICE and Border Patrol agents raiding places like car washes and Home Depots because they assume they'll find immigrants working there, using the fact that someone speaks Spanish to justify their suspicion that someone is here illegally.
It's just like Andrea. They detained her and immediately started speaking Spanish to her.
He's talking about Andrea Velez. In late June, her mother dropped her off at her job at a shoe company in downtown Los Angeles, just as immigration agents were raiding street vendors nearby. She looked up and saw a masked agent wearing a Hawaiian shirt running toward her as he chased someone.
And that's when he grabbed me and he slammed me to the sidewalk. I just remember the impact of how hard it was because it took me a while to get up.
The agent arrested her. As he restrained her, she says, a bystander began recording.
He was filming and he says, I'm going live. So that's when I proceeded to say my name and that I was a U.S. citizen. And then I even said my mother's name because I knew that maybe she was wondering I was probably not going to come home that night.
The agent who arrested her and another one drove Velez to the same downtown prison that Javier Ramirez had been taken to.
Once we got into the parking structure, they started talking to me in Spanish like they had not heard me before speak English. And I was like, I speak English too.
Velez was charged with assault on a federal officer and held for 2 days. Like Ramirez, the charge against her was eventually dropped. But for both of these U.S. citizens, the trauma lingers.
I still have a little bit of trouble just going outside by myself. Like, they could come, like, at any moment and just attack you again. And just trying to cope with, like, the anger of why did it happen? Because it's not supposed to happen here.
She started seeing a therapist to cope. Javier Ramirez did too. He says his family's humor is also helping.
I have one of my cousins right now, and he's like, every time, hey, I bought you your soda, just how you like it, without ice. So, you know, it's...
But Ramirez is angry. He says his rights were violated.
You know, as U.S. citizens, and that's what actually makes me mad, you know, because what's the whole point of the Constitution if they're not going to go by it?
He knows it'll be hard to hold federal agents accountable through claims for damages or lawsuits, but he says he has to try. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, Camilla Domonoski has a story on technology and trucking. Technology can make big rigs more comfortable and easier to drive, but will new tech improve drivers' jobs or eliminate them? That's ahead on All Things Considered. And coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. Support comes from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. And programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Taking a look at our weather for tonight, increasing clouds, lows in the 20s, cloudy tomorrow with highs near 40, chance of rain in the afternoon, winds from the south 5 to 15. Rain continues overnight, lows 30 to 34, and for Thursday, slight chance for some mixed precip early, partly sunny, highs 38 to 45. Our new Season Watch podcast explores nature as the seasons change. How do you change when fall turns to winter? You can text us 218-326-1234. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of gently used holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. For our next story, we're going inside the cab of a big rig. The U.S. needs more truck drivers, and right now, new technology is promising to help those drivers or to replace them. NPR's Camila Domonoski took a spin behind the wheel of a new big rig to see how cameras and computers can make a driver's job a little easier.
Joe Morrow has seen trucks change a lot in the 3 decades he's been driving. His very first truck, already old when he started driving it, the seat wouldn't even adjust.
And every bump that I would hit, my knees would hit the dash. Every one. I ended up getting like volleyball knee pads to drive that truck.
Today, he drives a new bright purple Volvo VNL, and there's no comparison, he says. It's more efficient, it's more comfortable, and with all the safety features.
I would say that this truck's easier to drive than most cars nowadays.
And I would say that I think he's right. This fall, Volvo Trucks invited journalists to South Carolina to try out these big rigs for ourselves. To be clear, this was on a closed test track. I had never driven an 18-wheeler before. Maddie Sullivan with Volvo showed me how the truck can detect a vehicle in front of it, thanks to cameras and radar.
And now you're just going to stay straight.
And I don't have to do anything,
you don't
right?
have to do anything.
Okay. On the test track, a car pulled out in front of me and suddenly slowed. The truck automatically braked.
And we're stopping. Go.
Then, like stop-and-go traffic, the car moved forward. The truck followed with a little lurch as 72,000 pounds heaved into motion. My foot didn't touch the pedal. Tech like this has been available in cars for years. The auto market is highly competitive and new features are selling points. It took longer to arrive in big rigs like this, which, despite their six-figure price tags, didn't used to have cutting-edge features.
Oh, I can feel the steering wheel. It's trying to keep me in the middle of the lane, right?
Earlier driver assist technology also annoyed professional drivers with all the beeping and interventions, but that's getting better, although, as you can hear, there is still some beeping.
Oh. It's because I'm speeding, isn't it?
Drivers don't tend to stick around in jobs in long-haul trucking. According to industry reports, annual turnover in big fleets frequently tops 90%. Big companies call this a trucker shortage. Drivers tend to say it's a sign of low wages and bad schedules, not to mention other frustrations, like a lack of the parking spaces that drivers need to sleep. Adding cameras and software can't solve those issues, but Volvo argues that trucks that are easier to drive and more comfortable could make trucking more appealing and help companies keep drivers longer.
Storage up here.
That's why the living space in this long-haul truck also got an upgrade. Tucked behind the seats, there's a table and chairs, storage nooks, fridge, TV, fold-down bed. Volvo let me test that, too.
Good night.
With an overnight stay. With curtains over the windows and a battery running the AC, the truck converts into something like an RV. I watched a little TV.
Well enough.
Made some tea in the microwave. And I slept great. But here's a plot twist. Does the truck of the future even need creature comforts? The week after my test drive, I saw a Volvo Big Rig a lot like the one I slept in, except there was a big empty space in back.
Here in the back where the VNL that I saw had a bed and a table.
Nope. This one has a computer, yes. You know, so we saved the bed, you know, space for a computer instead, yes.
That's Evandro Silva, who's in charge of maintaining the trucks at Volvo Autonomous Solutions. A sister company to Volvo Trucks, it's using cameras and sensors not to help drivers, but to replace them. But more on that tomorrow afternoon, when I take a ride in a driverless truck. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
The movie Wicked was one of last year's biggest blockbusters, and when the second part, called Wicked for Good, opens this weekend, it is expected to work similar magic.
I'm the Wicked Witch of the West.
The backstory of The Wicked Witch of the West seems to have cast a spell of attraction on audiences, from the best-selling book to the Broadway musical, and now this latest adaptation, which led NPR's Netta Ulaby to wonder, what do actual witches think of Wicked?
Hello, witches!
This is an occult-themed block party in Wayne, Michigan, near Detroit, where witches play live in a band that pays homage to Stevie Nicks and wander around booths selling tarot cards, healing herbs, and crystals. Tiffany Walker organized this event called Witches Be Witchin'. People today who call themselves witches, she says, draw from a number of spiritual and folk traditions.
Yeah, I consider myself an eclectic witch.
As does her friend, known in this community as Mama Rainbow.
I would also consider myself an eclectic witch.
Both so excited to be asked about Wicked.
Oh, yay! Oh my God, I love it so bad. I love Wicked too.
Wicked, they say, gives a long overdue, sympathetic spin to a figure who frightened generations of children in The Wizard of Oz.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog too.
This character, says Walker, enjoys a satisfying redemption arc in Wicked.
She's no longer scary or something to fear. You know, she's really this misunderstood hero.
With a set of pipes that would turn most of us green with envy.
It's time to try defying gravity.
I called a lot of witches. I could not find one who did not love Wicked.
Well, this witch loves Wicked.
She calls herself Juju Bay. She is a hoodoo practitioner in Brooklyn, an initiated ocean priestess, and a big old theater kid.
I am obsessed with Wicked. I love it. I cannot wait till the second half comes out.
That said, Bay still worries about how Wicked has helped make witchcraft mainstream. That's been happening for years, at least since 1990s movies like The Craft and Hocus Pocus. Since then, Bay says witchcraft has become, well, gentrified. You can buy tarot cards at Walmart. You can buy spells on Etsy. And it's possible, Juju Bay says, that Wicked success has contributed to an over-commercialization and over-consumption of a sacred and secret art.
I don't want to say it does because I love Wicked, but to an extent, yes, this is a Hollywood film. Of course, it is making witches more popular because it is an extremely popular show. I'm laughing because of Popular, and I'm like, that's one of my favorite songs in Wicked.
Popular, you're gonna be popular.
The character Glinda, who is singing, is a witch who could not be more different from the main character, says Heather Green. Green is a modern witch who wrote a book called Lights, Camera, Witchcraft, about how witches are represented in movies. Wicked gives us some much-needed witchly diversity, she says, but never loses focus on the one once known as the Wicked Witch of the West.
In a way that is very satisfying to practicing witches.
Unlimited.
And she's just an icon of the witch, so generally speaking, the witchcraft community just adores her.
And we'll be singing and cackling along when Wicked for Good opens on Friday. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And true, the vision's hazy, but I swear someday there'll be a celebration throughout Oz. It's all to do with me.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. Thanks for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the 20s.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. A Cass County deputy who was shot in an apparent exchange of gunfire during a foot pursuit on Sunday near Walker has been released from the hospital. The sheriff's office reported the deputy was treated for a gunshot wound to the upper right thigh at a Fargo, North Dakota hospital. The deputy is expected to make a full recovery. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is investigating the incident that resulted in the death of a man who allegedly fled from authorities after a 911 call reporting gunfire in Turtle Lake Township. Potato grower R.D. Offutt Farms agreed to pay more than $82,000 for failing to provide sick leave in 2024 as part of a settlement with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry announced on Monday. The payout went to 442 workers and represented the value of the time they were unable to use. The company also made nearly $81,000 in payments to migrant agricultural workers for not providing employment statements with key details, including wages, job duties, employment period, and housing arrangements. Under a law passed in 2023 in Minnesota, all employees are entitled to 1 hour of paid sick and safe time for every 30 hours worked, up to 48 hours a year. This is at least 6 days for a full-time employee. The Minnesota Reformer reports R.D. Offutt Farms told state labor regulators that sick leave was available to all employees, but the Department of Labor and Industry determined most employees were not able to use the time, and the company did not tell employees how much time they had accrued according to the settlement agreement. A spokesperson for R.D. Offutt told the Reformer in a statement that the company did comply with the, quote, spirit of the new regulation, but they acknowledged shortcomings on reporting requirements. R.D. Offutt Farms has more than 15 potato operations, including in Park Rapids, Perham Ottertail, Wadena, Staples, and Fort Ripley. Itasca County Habitat for Humanity is undertaking a new type of build with net zero homes under construction in Cohasset and Grand Rapids. Megan Buffington visited one and has more.
So it's sheetrock stage, so it's messy in here right now.
It was a cool, cloudy early November day, but Habitat for Humanity Executive Director Jamie Majelsness didn't even need a jacket inside the half-finished house in Cohasset. The 1,200-square-foot home was kept comfortable by two small portable heaters.
Realistically, without any heat source in this house right now, we could probably turn on a hairdryer and it would heat this whole building.
The home is incredibly energy efficient, thanks to the triple pane windows, extra thick slab and walls, and additional insulation in the walls and roof. Those, plus solar panels from a Minnesota power grant, mean the house will be net zero. That sounds more technical than it is in practice. It really just means there likely won't be an electricity bill. Even without the solar, it would only cost about $1,200 a year to heat and power the house. This type of construction is not only more affordable for the family, but it costs less to build. Majelsness says it's also just a better product. Energy efficiency is a growing trend in construction, and Majelsness wants to be part of it.
The more that we can build this way and showcase how well it works and how great it is for the family, not just for the environment, I think it becomes a no-brainer.
Itasca County Habitat for Humanity is thinking of what's best for each individual family first, but maybe it can spread throughout the state and catch on with habitats throughout the country too. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Bemidji Councilmember Audrey Thayer will serve on the board of directors for the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. The organization includes more than 100 cities throughout the state. As a board member, Thayer will help guide efforts to inform state legislators on issues important to Greater Minnesota. Other Northern Minnesota board members include First Vice President Rick Blake of the Grand Rapids City Council, Ely Mayor Heidi Omerza, and city administrators from Hibbing, Virginia, and Detroit Lakes. The coalition gathered last week at Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids for its fall conference, which included discussions about the upcoming changes to the state's paid leave law and a Grand Rapids case study of the growing legal cannabis industry. That's it for the Up North report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. During the Syrian civil war, millions of Syrians were displaced within the country and millions more fled abroad as refugees. It has been almost a year now since the war ended, and many Syrians are starting to come home. Some have found their houses destroyed, and others have found strangers living in their homes. NPR's Emily Fang and Jawad Rizala report on the thorny issue of sorting out what belongs to who after a war.
During the nearly 14 years of civil war, Syrians like 53-year-old Yasir Aboud were forced to abandon their houses. In his historically Christian village of Al-Ghassaniyah in northern Syria, Aboud says they were subjected to shelling, rockets, and barrel bombs, so most people fled. Then other displaced Syrians moved in. Rebel Syrian fighters, as well as Islamist fighters and foreign fighters from Chechnya, Uzbekistan, Morocco, and even thousands of ethnic Uyghur fighters fleeing China. Here's their deputy commander, a man who goes only by his first name, Jalaldin. He says Syrian rebel commanders told him, your fighters need houses, and you helped with liberating these areas. So go and live in empty houses whose owners left. So when they and other Syrians started trickling back home last December after the war ended, some of them were in for a surprise. 65-year-old Abdullah Ibrahim makes me a strong batch of cardamom-scented coffee and recalls finding the Uyghur fighters occupying his house and his olive groves last December. He's a longtime resident and the former mayor of Al-Ghassaniyah, the same village Aboud is from. Ibrahim says the women living in his home wore full black niqabs, leaving only their eyes uncovered. The male fighters largely did not speak Arabic, so he couldn't communicate with them. They cannot assimilate with Assyrians, he declares. They are different. This is why the land issue in Syria is so pressing. The new state wants displaced Syrians to come back to the country. But to do that, they need to clear up what belongs to who after the chaos of war, and to reassure Syrian minority groups, like Christians, such as Ibrahim, as well as Shiite Muslims, that they too can get their homes back.
First, they asked $50 per land.
This is Father Fadi Azar, a Catholic priest who helped with land negotiations. He says the Uyghurs wanted $50 a quarter acre because they argued they'd improved upon the land. After months of delays, Azar reached another agreement.
We wait until October. In October, they take the harvest, which is olives. And after that, we'll hand it totally to the people.
To hand the land back once the Uyghur fighters took the olive harvest. Ibrahim, the former village mayor, was among those waiting. And this October, he got an update from the government. He could get his property back.
Assalamu alaikum.
We went with Ibrahim to Al-Ghassaniya as he went to claim his land. First, he stopped by an old farmhouse. Inside its simple whitewashed walls, a displaced Syrian woman and her brother had been sheltering throughout the war, renting it from the foreign fighters who occupied it. Ibrahim clears his throat and declares formally to her, that the property is now his again. Nadia Sheikhol, the woman living in this house, is quiet. She understands this is tantamount to an eviction. She says she will leave peacefully. She explains how her brother is rebuilding the ground floor of their own home just a few miles away, which she fled during the war, in a chain reaction of destruction and displacement that reverberates to this day. Ibrahim had also just gotten back some of his olive groves, and he's been savoring this moment. The olive harvest. He planted the trees here himself more than 30 years ago in the red, chalky soil. And under the golden autumn sun, he gathers big handfuls of hard green olives for pickling to enjoy in the coming winter months. Harvesting olives is a joy we've been denied for 14 years, Ibrahim sighs. Weeks later, this November, Ibrahim texts back. All of his Christian neighbors have gotten their houses and land back as well from the Uyghur fighters. And his village held big celebrations. Maybe now, life after war can finally begin. Emily Fang, NPR News, Al-Ghassaniya, Syria.
Singer-songwriter Todd Snyder died last week at the age of 59. Snyder was a hero to many in alt-country music and the East Nashville scene he represented. In the days since his death, dozens of fellow artists have penned tributes to Snyder. He was a rambler and a poet who forged his own imperfect path. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has this appreciation.
When I asked several of Todd Snyder's peers and collaborators what they loved most about him, so many of them gave me a similar answer.
Todd was absolutely the master of telling the story.
That's Will Kimbrough. He started playing in Snyder's band in the 1990s. They were making rock music at the time, but continued working together as Snyder moved to Nashville and evolved into more of a folk, talking blues solo artist.
Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed.
Snyder made a name for himself as an incisive writer with an almost overwhelming empathy for the little guy. His songs reflected a winking self-awareness. Snyder was known to joke about working the couch circuit, sleeping wherever he could.
You know, when Todd first came out, people like Kris Kristofferson and John Prine really took note and said, who is this kid who's writing these songs that remind us of our generation?
Snyder was mentored by both. He signed to Jimmy Buffett's label in 1993 and later to Prine's. Throughout his career, he recorded more than a dozen albums and was especially loved for his live performances. Famously, he'd spend nearly 20 minutes just introducing a song, all while holding the audience's attention.
Who does that besides a stand-up comedian?
Singer-songwriter Rod Picott says for him, the magic lived in Snyder's words.
Todd inhabited a very rare place in terms of his songwriting. But it's that kind of place where melancholy and sadness sort of meet up with humor, which makes the humor funnier and makes the melancholy sadder.
All I wanted was one chance to let freedom ring. Said I had to get a permit, tags and everything.
Snyder was also a mentor. He convinced Aaron Lee Tazjan to move to Nashville in the late 2000s, and then he helped the guitarist launch his own solo career.
He was so beautiful and encouraging to so many of us.
Todd Snyder was also very open about his struggles with addiction, with chronic pain, with life at large. His last album, High, Lonesome, and Then Some, came out last month, and it grappled with a dark time in his life.
He was always very honest with himself. He was always very honest with his audience. He never tried to make things seem better than they were, but yet he had this hopeful air about everything in his life.
Old timer, old timer, too late to die young now.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Old timer.
five and dimer trying to find a way to...
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The tech company Meta won a victory in federal court today. A judge ruled it is not operating as an illegal monopoly. The decision means Meta will not be forced to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp. The ruling comes after a seven-week trial back in April. NPR's Bobby Allen covered that trial and joins us now to talk about what this all means for Meta and the tech industry as a whole. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Scott.
Let's start with the decision. What exactly did the judge rule?
Yeah, at a high level, the federal judge, James Boasberg, said the Federal Trade Commission did not clear the high bar for establishing Meta as a monopoly. In order to show any given company is monopolizing a market, you have to define that market. And here, regulators argued Meta was abusing power in the personal social networking market, meaning chatting with friends and family on social media. But Boasberg said that definition had one big problem. It didn't include TikTok and YouTube, which Meta said are its two biggest competitors.
Why would they leave two giant companies off the definition?
Part of the reason is when this case was filed back in 2020 during Trump's first term, TikTok was not as big as it is today. Technology, of course, moves much faster than antitrust lawsuits. So when the trial happened 5 years later, the social media ecosystem looked very different and TikTok was dominant. More than half of Americans use the app now. When Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg took the witness stand during this trial, he really emphasized this, that TikTok is a fierce rival. And it's no coincidence that one of Instagram's most popular features today, Reels, is basically a clone of TikTok.
So this is a big win for Meta. Was it surprising, though?
You know, not entirely. The lawsuit was filed with the aim of breaking up Meta, with forcing the spinoff of Instagram and WhatsApp into separate companies. And while there are loud bipartisan cries in Washington to rein in the power of big tech, actually doing so remains quite hard. In this case, regulators said Meta would not be so powerful today if it hadn't bought WhatsApp and Instagram, that it purchased those companies to neutralize a competitive threat. But look, Scott, both of those deals were approved by the FTC at the time. And I talked to legal experts who said reassessing those deals now is going to be a real uphill battle for the government. But there are other cases in this legal push against Silicon Valley. Cases are still pending against Apple and Amazon. And Google lost two cases against the Department of Justice. We're waiting to see what a judge does in those.
This case stretched back several years, but the big shift that we've seen has been tech leaders really embracing the Trump administration's. How do we make sense of these lawsuits in light of that?
Yeah, the executives in Silicon Valley have hoped that praising the president and changing policies to appease Trump would give them something concrete, like maybe having these lawsuits go away, right? Mm-hmm. But we just haven't seen that happen. Some of the cases were filed in Trump's first term, others in Biden, so in both administrations. In all of them, though, Scott, Trump has taken a hands-off approach and just let them unfold in the courts. You can even see how the suits could be used as leverage for the White House when it's talking to tech companies, when the administration is seeking something from them, right? When the administration needs something. Mm-hmm. You know, while those discussions are going on, hanging over the companies are these big antitrust suits, which can be incredibly costly, time-consuming, and even force them to entirely overhaul their businesses.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear our album of the week. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. And we thank Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the 20s, and tomorrow cloudy, highs near 40, chance of rain in the afternoon, winds from the south 5 to 15. Rain continues tomorrow night, lows 30 to 34, and looking ahead to Thursday, slight chance for some mixed precip early, partly sunny, highs 38 to 45. If you are at least 70 and a half years old, supporting KAXE's future is easy. You can ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to benefit KAXE. If you have questions, you can call Chris 218-326-1234. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. More news is next.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. There's a village on India's western coast where tourists gather to cheer on baby turtles that are trying to crawl into the sea. The turtles are olive ridleys. They inhabit a band of tropical waters around the world, and they are considered threatened by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. But as NPR's Dia Hadid reports, efforts like the Veras Turtle Festival are helping them thrive.
Tourists watch volunteers gather newly hatched turtles from inside a hatchery. It's like an animal pen on the sand. These turtle eggs had been collected a few weeks ago from the Veras shore, from turtle nests. That is a hole dug by a female olive ridley with her flippers, where she lays dozens of eggs inside. The volunteers dug them out and put them in this hatchery to protect them from predators like dogs and gulls. Volunteers plop the wriggly little hatchlings onto the sand.
Ah, see, Nana, the tennis is running.
Kids squeal as the hatchlings lurch towards the sea.
Where are they going? Where are they going?
The babies reach the frothy, salty fringe. Waves pull them in. Tourists clap. The Veras Turtle Festival has run for about a decade. It's the brainchild of local Mohan Upadhyay. We meet in his garden.
I see you have a tattoo on your arm that says, yes. Save me.
A turtle tattoo.
It's having two meanings. If people will save me, then I will save him.
Save humans from ecological destruction. He says conservationists thought olive ridleys disappeared from these parts in the 90s for the same reasons that their populations were collapsing across India over the decades, swept up in fishing nets, butchered for their leather and meat, their eggs poached. But Upadhyay says in the early aughts, a worker from a local nature charity stumbled onto a turtle eggshell on the Veras shore. Pretty soon, Upadhyay was helping the charity identify turtle nesting sites.
I was in love with sea turtles.
He convinced villagers to ban seaside construction to protect the nesting sites because at least some of the surviving females born on this beach will return to it to lay their own eggs. It's not clear why olive ridley turtles do that, but it's why protecting their nesting sites is so key to protecting the species. Upadhyay created incentives for locals to support his efforts, like creating the Veras Turtle Festival, which brings tourists and their money to town. Now,
there are two villages who are replicating this model.
Since they began work, Upadhyay says they've gone from finding sporadic turtle nests to counting about 70 over the last nesting season. Patchwork efforts like this around the country have staved off an expected collapse in olive ridley numbers. Kartik Shankar is one of India's preeminent experts on olive ridley turtles. He says across India last year, conservationists counted
about 1 million nests, which is crazy high.
1 million turtle nests.
Seems to me that olive ridley turtles have bounced back quite substantially.
But still, they are designated globally as threatened, and they're still facing dangers in India. Much of the effort, though, to protect India's sea turtles can be traced back to one man, Satish Bhaskar. A documentary was made about him last year called The Turtle Walker. Bhaskar earned the name after he spent years walking some 2,500 miles across India's shorelines to map turtle habitats. He says in the documentary,
I couldn't stop thinking about these very mysterious animals.
The data that Bhaskar produced has guided conservationists for decades. Back in the village of Veras, Mohan Upadhyay, who created the Turtle Festival, says of Satish Bhaskar, the turtle walker,
he's actually God.
He says it's not just the data Bhaskar produced, it's the awe he inspired for sea turtles. And Upadhyay hopes that among the tourists who cheer on the baby turtles crawling into the sea during the Veras Turtle Festival, he'll find new people who have that awe for sea turtles and who'll protect them for another generation. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Veras.
Have you ever had a bite of cheese that changed your life? Perry Wakeman has.
There's that one moment in life where you try an artisan cheese and you want to know more about who made it, how it's made. You want to go back to the store, buy it again, seek it out, share it with friends.
You could say Wakeman is something of a cheese aficionado. He matures cheese for a living in the UK. And he was one of the top judges at the World Cheese Awards last week in Bern, Switzerland.
The festivities began with the blaring sounds of long wooden outpourings as Wakeman and the other judges paraded into the hall in bright yellow aprons.
You can see basically a sea of cheese, which is a total of 5,244 cheeses from 46 different countries. And to put that in a visual context, it's about the size of a football field.
A football field's worth of cheeses waiting to be winnowed down to the 14 top cheeses in the world. Wakeman had the task of selecting one of the finalists for consideration, and he chose an 18-month-aged Swiss Gruyere.
Now, I got a knife, plunged it through the cheese and kind of did a twisting action. And then I twist, the kind of cheese popped open. It was almost flinty in texture. It kind of broke apart in a really nice, clean way. And I brought it to my nose and there was this really nice warmed milk, sweet, savory kind of aroma, really, really complex. And then the important part, I popped it in my mouth and it was just stunning. Savory, roasted nut. There was some sweet butterscotch that was in there.
That sounds delicious.
It does, and the judges thought so too.
All right, we have got a 5, a 6, a 7, a 6.
They are casting their votes there on a scale of 1 to 7.
And cheese number 7, that score is about to come up on that screen.
The Gruyere became world champion, beating out more than 5,000 other cheeses.
And the finalists also included cheeses from other places that you might expect, like France, the Netherlands, the UK, and Spain. But there were some scrappier contestants in the final round, too, like a Slovakian cheese.
The salt balance was perfect. It was a really well-balanced cheese.
There was also a Japanese goat cheese that Wakeman described as a revelation, a sign that Japan's growing cheese industry might pull off an upset in the years to come.
I'm really fascinated to see how quickly their cheese-making artisan craft has come on. And I would tip them to do a bit of a surprise next year and really shock the world.
And Juana, we would be remiss if we did not mention the one homegrown U.S. cheese in the finals, a cheddar.
Pleasantly surprised. That sounds sarcastic, doesn't it? But, you know, as the Brit,
I think that means it's time to do a taste test. American cheddar versus British cheddar.
You know, Scott, old rivalries do die hard.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on ARM. ARM.com. This is NPR.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, Sarah Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty